It is time to open the meeting of the Board of Adjustments. So I'm calling to order the meeting at 6:32. We need to make an amendment to the agenda. We're supposed to, at this meeting under new business, appoint an alternate into a full member's position, since one of our, I think Tony is now on planning and zoning, so he will no longer be a member.
So you want to entertain a motion to amend the agenda?
So I would like to make a motion to amend the agenda.
I'll second. Third.
Okay.
Okay.
Aye. All in favor?
Aye.
And that
agree.
Motion was to add a new item of new business?
To add, okay.
What do you want to call it, 7B, and renumber the other sections thereafter?
Under new business, it would be 5? No, it would be...
5?
Yes. 3, 4, 5.
New business is Article 5. You've got subsections A, B, and C there under. I would suggest that you add the new agenda item as B and renumber B and C as C and D.
Okay. So,
I'll second that.
All in favor?
Yeah. Aye.
Okay.
Aye. Will we then adopt the agenda as amended?
Usually you would do that all as one, but now you can entertain a motion to adopt the agenda.
All right. A motion to adopt the agenda.
Okay.
Make a motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Our next item is the approval of minutes from May 28, 2019. And since I was the only one there, everything looks good to me. So if you guys see anything that you would like to, you have a question about, we can answer it and then go ahead and make a motion to approve the minutes from May's meeting.
I'll second.
All right, and make the motion. All right.
Okay.
And you second, all in favor?
Aye.
To approve? Aye. Old business. I don't think we have any old business.
The agenda doesn't reflect any.
No, I don't believe we have any old business, so we'll move from old business to new business. And the first thing we'll do is elect a chairman and a vice chairman position. Do I have any person here that wants to make any kind of a suggestion as to chairman?
I'll make the suggestion that the chair and the vice chair stay as previous.
And I will second it.
So you'll make a motion to keep Harry Humphries as chairman and Ann Broski as vice chairman?
You do such a wonderful job.
Twice a year? I guess I can do that.
Yep.
And Ian seconds it. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. The next will be to appoint either Randy or Connie. Connie just showed up. From an alternate to take Tony's position on the board.
May I make a few comments about that?
You may, sir.
Staff looked through the code and looked through your rules of procedure and noticed several things about this item. One, you're the only public body in the town that's got two alternate members. That presents a bit of a problem since the code and the rules of procedure fail to spell out, not a problem, but require some consideration because there's no provision outlining how you choose which of the two alternates you have to fill the one position that needs to be filled. It also led staff to consider, and I believe this will be the case, let me back up, in addition to having the issue of how you choose the alternate, there apparently are problems of advertising for a sufficient number of alternate members to be considered for appointment. Staff will recommend to council that we revise that part of the code and provide for one alternate for this board instead of two, which eliminates both problems. And
I just thought about something, if you don't mind me.
No, please do.
But in the event we only have three and we have a case, wouldn't we need both alternates to have a full board?
If you only have three, your full board's five.
Right.
Just so like right now,
oh,
we
okay,
have.
Gotcha, yeah.
That would be a quorum.
But if we were only having three, okay, I was gone.
Four would
I
make a quorum.
Of the three tonight and then only having one alternate, that would bring you to four.
The, what's four fifths of five? Four?
Four.
Yeah, okay.
That still works because for a variance, you need a super majority of four fifths. If it were four, with an alternate, you'd still have
four.
Okay.
I think we're okay with one.
Because you guys are like, only want the alternate instead, and as a member,
that's right.
Yeah.
So are we still advertising for more?
We have been, and we haven't had any responses.
I haven't had any responses or any applications towards the board.
Okay.
I mean, if y'all know some people that you could tell, hey, go apply.
That would be helpful.
So with respect to filling this position, the board may want to consider who's present. Board may want to consider the seniority of the alternate members. I believe the gentleman has a year ahead of the lady. But the board may also want to consider preferences. It may be that if the gentleman was here, he may not be interested and the lady may be. So these are the items we suggest that you all consider as you pick the alternate to fill that position, but there is no formal procedure to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any feedback on reducing the number of alternates to one versus two? Is that okay with you guys?
As long as we can, that alternate shows up, then we can have a quorum. That's good.
I agree with that.
That's fine.
Well, you'll have a full board plus an alternate, so you should be able to fill the quorum, and I'm sure that will do everything you can.
Well, I think we have. Did we not come up with... You couldn't be absent from these meetings without an excuse. If you're absent from more than
three.
Then you're automatically dismissed from the board.
Yeah, but you've never had three meetings in a year.
I know. But this is two for Peter.
Well, let me check. I don't have my BO.
No, wait a minute. Peter was here in May. So Peter was here at the last one. Peter was here in May. So this would be the first one.
And it may be that the maximum of three absences would be within a calendar year. That's what we're looking at right now, instead of three during the
year. It would make more sense to be in a calendar year.
Well, we don't even have three meetings ever in a calendar
year.
We did probably 10 years ago.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
We did that tonight.
Have you spoken with Peter?
Again, for the three times in the next 12 months. So it would roll from.
I don't know that he really
wants to.
January comes in through.
Not a calendar year.
So who would be the most appropriate to reach out to Peter to see if he is in a position where he would want to continue or if he would want to resign?
Well, I don't know that you. I guess, based on that question, the board could table this issue until the next meeting and then have the next meeting next month in order to follow up with Peter, or in lieu of that, the board could go ahead and make its appointment, which could be Peter, or could be, I'm sorry,
it's
you person?
Randy
or Connie. I think we should go ahead and appoint the alternate to the board to take Tony's position, and then we'll see what happens at the next meeting. Unless
someone reaches out and communicates with Peter.
I think that's staff's position, that we could go ahead and take care of this agenda item.
Okay. Staff?
Well, it's up to you all.
Well, I look at it this way in the discussion of who we should pick.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at the fact that Randy had been an alternate a year longer than Connie. So I was leaning in that direction. But now I look out into our meeting and I see Connie's here and Randy's not. So I would rather go with someone who obviously shows, I think you were here for the May meeting, is too. Yes. She was here for the May meeting, and
Randy
was not. So I would, my suggestion would be the person that appears to, if you are willing to step up to be a member of the board, nominate Connie as the board member from being an alternate to a board member.
Is that a motion? And if it
No, it's just discussion right now.
I think that's a brilliant idea.
I tend to agree, having missed two back-to-back.
Right, well, Connie's then, made then I'll make a motion. Connie, would you be willing to step up as a board member?
Yes, I would.
I'd like to make a motion to appoint Connie as our full-time board member from alternate to full-time board.
And I think you can put both our names down as seconding.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Connie, welcome.
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 Thank you.
Come on
get your,
up.
Get your
I can get them up there. Right?
You get to move up here. That's right.
Come on up. There's paper and pencil.
I was confused when I walked in and saw you sitting up there on the podium. I was like, wow. It's like a diet.
So that means we now have four active members. Who's going to reach out to Peter?
I will get his number and call.
Just to make sure it's not like we're not penalizing him, and just like, hey, where you stand?
Well, I wanted to reach out to him because his wife had the same problem my wife had, so if that's becoming a problem for his, and I know it's going to be,
right.
Then he may want to step down.
Yeah. Well, just like when I step down.
But I'm just
going to
ask him how things are going.
Yeah.
Well, Barbara's got it. I'll get it for you.
Okay. Do we need to put that in the minutes, or we'll just leave it as?
Just leave it.
Okay.
You've already taken an oath, right?
Yes, I did.
Hop on up there.
Come on
you
up.
Don't mind, do you?
No, I'll come
I mean,
up here. How do I get up there?
With okay. The appointment right. Comes certain responsibilities. You've got to walk up those steps.
Got a ramp.
That's yeah, we just in case you're a handicap.
In case I'm handicapped, there's a ramp.
Perfect.
All right, very good.
Thank you.
All right, the next item on the agenda is the 2019 annual report. And in this packet here, it shows that council approved Connie as an alternate member, and they'll now endorse her as a regular member. They approved the resignation of Tony on November 20th because he went to P&Z.
Mm-hmm.
We do have five current members, even with Connie now coming on. We have five current members, and we only have one alternate member. So is this part of what we're going to do is make this recommendation to have council go ahead and go with one alternate?
I think the item that's before you is to approve
just this
report here.
All right.
And I think I've already conveyed that staff, we've already discussed staff's proposal to seek to amend the code for one alternate, and we've already had a consensus.
Okay.
We will all to move forward.
Okay.
So the only item you're considering now is that.
Okay. At we had some training. We scheduled one training session in 2019, which Mr. Aldridge gave us some great background. Some of us, you know, he just refreshed us, and like Connie got it firsthand, learned some good things. There were no cases presented before the board in 2019. Which is good. Swell, right?
Yes, it does.
So that is the annual report for 2019. Do I have a motion to accept the annual report?
I'll make a motion.
I'll second.
All in favor to approve it?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. The next item on the agenda is, again, Mr. Aldridge needs to bring us up to speed on some things.
Thanks, Chairman.
So what I would like to do is move down to the tables and get comfortable and let Mr. Aldridge
help us out.
Come on down. Did everybody bring their agenda packet material with them?
Yes.
Maybe it gets better. Yeah, just a little bit.
Looks like most of you have already done it, but if you could turn to the page that says memorandum. This won't take very long. It's informal, and if you want to have a give and take, just jump in. That's fine. Training, but it's really it's both training and a legislative update. And before you read the I'll refer to the memorandum, but you don't need to read it as we have our discussion. Every once in a while, the General Assembly tinkers around with planning and development statutes, and they certainly have done so in the last session, 2019. Mandy, Beth, and I, and some members of PZC, and I guess Mr. Whitley from the council, and the other gentleman who's
Colin
left.
Oliver.
Yeah, Mr. Oliver. We attended a regional workshop last Thursday in Wilmington, where representatives from the School of Government briefed us on these legislative changes. And there's two sets of legislative changes. One is a set that's currently effective, which we'll discuss tonight. And the other set will not be effective until January 1 next year. Why that? The second set that will be effective a year from now, there was one session law that was passed, 2019-111. And it has three parts. The third part deals with the effective dates. That's neither here nor there. The first part are the currently effective legislative changes, which came into effect in July. The second part is a recodification of recodification and consolidation. They took all the county land development statutes, and they took all the city land development statutes and they rewrote them and merged them into a new chapter in the general statutes, Chapter 160D. Currently, we're all operating under Chapter 160A. That's municipal laws. So the fact that they've rewritten all those laws means that every local government, county, and city needs to rewrite their ordinances, hence the effective date a year from now to allow all that work to happen. They're having regional workshops. They've actually published a book on it. It's a 200-page session law, so you can see there's a bunch of work that needs to be done. What I found interesting, and I didn't realize it at the time, the reason, and it went through, I believe it went through unanimously, or at least it went through this time, the recodification, this part two, this chapter 160D, had come up in the two previous sessions, but never got anywhere. This time, it got someplace. Something in me thinks it was unanimous, and the governor signed it into law. There was no controversy, but I learned in the regional workshop that this was the case because the part one of that session law, the part that we're going to talk about tonight, the part that is currently effective, was proposed by, written by, lobbied by, and pushed by developers and homeowners, realtors or the construction industry, just leave it at that. And you'll see how that's reflected in the changes that we're going to talk about tonight. So to use a current term of art, there was a quid pro quo. The developer said, if you pass part one, we won't oppose part two. And that's why we got the giant session law that we got. The last time we were together, we talked about, in our previous training sessions, we talked about quasi-judicial procedures and how that differs from a normal public hearing, and that everything that comes before you is done in a quasi-judicial manner. And I don't know if you were around for any of that. The last time we were together, we referred especially to the statute that controls the record and the rights and the procedures associated with a judicial review of a quasi-judicial decision. In other words, if I come before you all and I get a decision that I don't like, I can take it, I can petition the court for judicial review, and we walk through that statute. You might recall there was discussions about non-expert opinion regarding traffic impacts and property value and how that didn't rise to the level of competent testimony, although the you all could consider it, but you'd have to give it its due weight because it wasn't by an expert. We also talked about, and I think I used a case that I had recently obtained a significant victory, and we talked about supplementing the record. If you'll remember that case, I claimed that we lost a short-term rental battle with the Wilmington's BOA, and we took the position, and the city had pointed to A, B, and C as in their code as regulating that short-term rental use, and the BOA bought it. But we took the position that the code didn't regulate short-term rental use, and in particular those provisions that the city pointed to didn't regulate it. And you'll recall that the city eventually did pass short-term rental text amendments to their code, and that the submission of those text amendments was covered by a letter from the city manager where he clearly states that heretofore the code didn't include these provisions. So when we went to the statute and we talked about how a record could be, the record of you all supplemented at the court level with additional information, you might recall that in that case that I was referring to, we moved the court to include the cover letter from the manager because the manager said, hey, we never had anything like this in our code before, and the court granted that, and we used that admission against the city's argument that the code did in fact regulate it. You know, you can't have it both ways. The city can't say, well, these regulate it, and then years later the city manager passes along text amendments and says we need these because we don't have them. So it was very helpful. So we're going to talk about that tonight because they've tweaked that statute. That's 168.393. They've also added a new statute, 168.393.1. And they also made some changes to quasi-judicial rights and procedures. And most importantly, they've added some, and again, remember, this was the developer's bill. They've added some very significant provisions regarding the mandatory award of attorney's fees against local government under certain conditions. So that has raised the stakes considerably. I'm involved in a simple lawsuit in the southern part of Brunswick County where I represent a town against a POA, and that's a fairly simple suit where the legal fees, I'm sure, of the POA are they're probably 60, or, well, I know from a mediation they're probably 70,000, 80,000 right now. In the Belleville, Leland, H2Go litigation, those three towns together have incurred over $2 million in legal fees in an 18-month period. Leland has incurred $800,000 of legal fees. So when you're talking about a new amendment that requires, doesn't say the court may, the court shall award attorney's fees, and you're dealing with even reasonable numbers down in my situation in Brunswick County of 60, 70, 80,000, you can see that that statute has created a new ball game, so to speak. So let's talk about these things.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
So that's saying that if the developer,
if we're going to talk about okay. in specific the attorney's fees provisions.
Okay.
Now, if you take this memorandum, let's skip the memorandum, go to the behind the next page. The memorandum's two pages. Go to the third page. The top should be section 1.7, and you'll see some yellow highlights there. Has everybody got that? Basically, this is a new responsibility. This is an amendment. This is that new statute I referred to. Again, the record statute is 393. This is a new statute, 393.1, that deals with quasi-judicial procedures in several respects. But the first thing I want to point out is it has added to the... Right now you handle administrative appeals, and right now you handle variances. Now there's a new thing that you will handle. If somebody submits a request to the zoning officer to inquire whether they have vested rights in a project, and the zoning officer, or John in our case, writes back and says, no, we don't believe you do have vested rights, that comes to you all now for a quasi-judicial procedure where you have to determine whether who's right in that matter.
Can you do me a favor? Mm-hmm. Can you define vested rights?
You segued right into my next set of remarks. Vested rights are, you get vested rights when you basically have a land development proposal approved, and it can come in different ways. If you bring a preliminary plat of a subdivision and that's approved, you have a vested right to develop that property. And what the vested means is, the rules and regulations that were in effect at the time you obtained that approval are the rules and regulations you can proceed under, notwithstanding any amendments to those rules and procedures. So if I got approval X today and council 6 months from now changes the way that particular project changes the rules and regulations regarding that particular development proposal, they don't affect me because I'm vested. I can keep going under the regs that were in place when I got that approval. I always have to check on this, but I think a vested right is good for 2 years, and you can provide for longer based on a base.
So for two, that would only
it's 7 years.
Relevant for 2 years.
You have to start work within 2 years.
Okay.
And a multi-phase development, 7 years.
So, just to clarify, I'd like to use an example. So, like, when I get a building permit, mm-hmm. I am required under that building permit to follow the rules of, if it was a 2019 building permit, and then we had code changes in 2020, I only have to follow the 19 building permit. So that would be... That's kind of what we follow. So that would be a similar situation.
Well, you've raised a matter that I wasn't going to get into because it doesn't concern you all, but I'll go ahead and reference it. For purposes of our discussion, we're going to limit our understanding of the topic to the fact that if you're approved, you're insulated from changes okay. for 2 years. However, one of the big things that they pass, which PZC and council will consider, it doesn't fall into your jurisdiction at all, it's called the permit choice rule. And that's it's very much part and parcel of vested rights. It comes out of vested rights. Mm-hmm. But it basically says that, so if you're vested, you're vested, period. Under the permit choice rule, if they change the rules and you like the new rules, you can choose to keep those rules. Yeah. And it gets very complicated because the permit choice rule is triggered by the initial approval, even though there are subsequent, and is triggered by the initial approval and impacts the subsequent approvals that that project goes through. For example, you get preliminary plat approval, you get zoning compliance approval, you get a building permit, you get a CO. In this hypothetical, we've got four different sets of approvals. Mm-hmm. The permit choice rule allows you to apply the rules and regulations that were in place when you got the subdivision approval throughout the entire process, or you can cherry pick and pick if there are new rules that are more favorable at a later stage. You have the choice to go back and forth on that. So that's the permit choice rule, which is distinct from vested rights, but forever linked. Forever linked.
So to keep up with.
What's that? Yeah. Yeah, I mean.
As the quasi, we're going to be perhaps dealing with vested right.
Only, not permit choice.
Okay, that's, I was going to ask the same question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, theoretically, I guess permit choice could come to you if an interpretation, you know, if somebody is noticed for a violation of rules and he feels that that developer feels that they had made clear that they wanted the different set of rules, well, that appeal can come to you also. I guess you could get caught up in a permit choice rule issue. But my point tonight is that a new matter that has been put into your bailiwick is to review a vested rights claim. In an administrative appeal, the permit choice rule may become an issue. But you're not here to do a quasi-judicial.
If the contractor or the person that's building the property is in favor of whatever the new choice is in the permit choice rule, why would they even bring it before them?
Because take, for example, that the building inspector applies the old rules where the developer wants the new rules.
Okay.
And the developer would then appeal that.
The decision of the building inspector. Okay.
Okay. Having
we do.
Did some other group have responsibility for review of vested rights before, or no one did?
That's a good question. It wasn't carved out. But I could see Board of Adjustments can hear decisions and interpretations of zoning regulations. So I think it's quite possible that somebody could request. I think it could have come up by somebody requesting an interpretation and getting an interpretation they didn't like. But the point is now it is in black and white.
Right. Okay.
Now the next thing that's in black and white is very significant. Instead of things by default coming to you by statute, now in certain situations the applicant can take the matter directly to civil superior court and bypass you. So when you, again, remember this is the developer's building, so if you couple that option with the attorney's fees, you can see how the leverage exists or how the stakes have increased. Why, you know, if I feel very comfortable, why am I going to waste my time? I'm going to go right to court, go after you, and try to get my attorney's fees. You know, I think the environment is a lot more threatening than it ever used to be. But what are the circumstances that that can happen in? Well, they're fairly broad, meaning that any decent attorney can make the argument. And so let's look at them under that highlight for civil action. It basically says that claims involving questions of interpretation may bring in a, claims as set forth in 123 below may bring an original civil action seeking declaratory relief, injunctive relief, or damages for any of the following. And it also says in superior or federal court, and it's hard to get into federal court, but boy, if you get into federal court, everything is the ante goes way up. You can do something in state court that takes an hour. It takes 3 hours to do it in federal court. I'm talking about motions and things like that. So the attorney's fees would really accelerate. But here are the bases that entitles an applicant to go to court instead of you all. If they can make the argument that the subject ordinance is unconstitutional, if they can make the argument that the action taken by the town is ultra vires, which means in excess of authority. Look, if a town says no when a applicant wants them to say yes, one of the common arguments would always be that that exceeds their authority because they're wrong. So it's very easy, I think, to get to court and bypass you all. Preempted or otherwise in excess of statutory authority. Again, if you deny something wrongfully, I'd say you were in excess of your statutory authority. Or if they can make the argument that the ordinance constitutes a taking of property. So the bottom line is, but I will say this, and let me look at my memo. Some of this language that are in the new Part 1 and Part 2, Part 2 being 160D, is not well written. For example, I'll give you an idea, or give you an example. In 160D, which doesn't become effective for another year, slightly less than a year, there is a provision regarding appealing subdivision decisions. The decision allows the appeal to be taken either to Superior Court or to the Board of Adjustment, but it doesn't. It doesn't spell out the procedure that the Board of Adjustment would use in reviewing that decision. Now, you all are used to quasi-judicial procedures, which is basically an evidentiary process. Somebody comes in with a claim, they bring witnesses and documents, and they have to prove their case. Well, if you took your subdivision decision to Superior Court, that court is going to review the record below. They don't take any new evidence. They don't take any new exhibits. Query, if that subdivision appeal comes to you all, do you simply look over the record of that preliminary plat approval, which I think is PZC review and council action, or do you do a quasi-judicial procedure and review it de novo as if it never happened? I don't know. That's one of the things that the statutes are not clear of. I digress. But I wanted to point out that there is a limitation on going directly to court, and that limitation is let me find it. It's not really a limit. Oh, appeals of ordinance interpretations must still come before the board before petitioning for judicial review. If you go back to your highlighted copy of the statute, and again, anything that's underlined when we're looking at these statutes, that means it's new. If it's crossed out, that's old. If it's underlined, it's new. If you look at B1, if you go to the paragraph below B3, it starts out, if the decision being challenged is from an administrative official charged with enforcement of a regulation, the party of standing must first bring that claim of erroneous interpretation to the Board of Adjustment. So if you're dealing with a simple, and that's always been the case, that has not changed. So if I write John a letter and he writes back an interpretation that I don't like, even if I think it's unconstitutional or in excess of statutory authority, in that instance, I still have to come to you all first. I cannot go directly to court. Last year, when we had training, we spoke about standing, and we talked about, and standing is this. If I'm the applicant, I've got standing to come before you all, and I've got standing to seek judicial review. Where it gets weedy is with respect to opponents. Joe Blow lives across the street from your proposed campground. He thinks it's going to reduce his property values. Does he have standing to participate as a party in the quasi-judicial And also, does he have standing in the event of a bad decision to go to court and appeal that, seek judicial review? And it never, so what 393.1, which is a new statute, sets out in C, where I've highlighted standing, it sets out clear standards for who has standing to do those things. Number one, the person has an ownership, leasehold, or easement interest in, or has an option or contract to purchase the property. Number two, the person was an applicant for a development permit before the decision-making board whose decision is being challenged. Council denies a special use permit. He can take that the applicant that was denied has standing to bring that decision for judicial review into court. Or the person was an applicant for a development permit who was aggrieved by a final and binding decision of John, for example, that's charged with applying or enforcing a land development regulation. I may be on an ancillary track, and Beth may have applied for a permit, and we're both looking for the same sort of thing, and her decision for shut me down without me being part of the process, I can also go to court and seek a judicial review of that. So the bottom line is, this statute makes clear who has standing. And we talked about the record statute, 393, last year, because sometimes in the midst of a hearing, you need to know the things beyond what's in front of you so that you can do as good a job as you can during the hearing. So if you have these clear standards and you're having a hearing, and somebody says, I oppose that project and I want to participate in this hearing. Well, the chairman, because again, the attorney doesn't want to give you advice during the hearing because then I become a witness. The chairman could recall, well, wait a minute, this statute, and he might even look at it ahead of time, and he could formulate, if you knew there was a red button issue that was going to be heard, and you knew people were, there was a segment of the population that was very opposed to this project, my suggestion is you look at 393.1 ahead of time and you jot out some questions in case an opponent gets up there, and you can inquire, because you got the right to do it, whether he has standing or not by asking him these questions. You don't say, do you have standing? You ask him questions along these lines. And I don't expect you to remember all this, but that's important because one of the changes in 160D is as follows. An opponent who does not have standing, the board may decide to hear what he has to say, but only parties, i.e. people that have standing, can cross-examine and offer evidence. So you could be in a quasi-judicial, somebody could get up and say, I want to testify, and I want to offer witnesses, and I want to offer exhibits. You might want to inquire as to their standing to do so, because if they don't have that standing, they're limited to just producing comments. They can't put forth witnesses or exhibits. You can always err on the side of caution and let it in, but you're only, you could do that in the hopes that a court would catch it, but if you do that, you may also set the scenario for somebody to bring the civil action. He let me in, but they still, maybe he let him in when he shouldn't have been let in. Maybe he put forth a witness when he shouldn't have put forth a witness. He doesn't like the decision. He probably has enough to get into court. He might get tossed out later, but you're in court and you're spending attorney's fees. He may not win, he may not get attorney's fees, but you're still spending attorney's fees.
Now, but the person who is actually bringing the action to the board, they can call, they can call witnesses.
I would suggest to you that that fits into 1, 2, or 3 very clearly.
Yes.
Number two, the person was a development permit applicant before the decision-making board whose decision is being challenged.
Yeah, but if somebody just says, I'd like to, you know, talk, we have allowed their opinion before.
Opinion's the wrong word, comments.
Or comments, I'm sorry.
Look, here's how it works. I'm you, okay? The applicant is in front of me. He makes his proposal. He puts on his witnesses. He offers his exhibits. Joe Blow stands up and says, I'm opposed to this project. A year from now, I have a statutory requirement that Joe Blow is reduced to either making comments or is entitled to present witnesses and testimony. In order for me to do my job as well as I can, for this Board of Adjustment to do its job as well as it can, and knowing what I know as today, I would ask several questions of Joe Blow based on C-123 and determine whether I thought he had standing or not. And I may go so far as to say, Mr. Joe Blow, you're welcome to make any comments, but for the record, I don't believe you have, the board does not believe you have standing, and we will not entertain any witnesses on your behalf or any, nor will we accept any exhibits on your behalf. Joe Blow can always go to court and make his case, and if he's right, well, then the court will supplement that record. If he's wrong, which is more than likely true, if you've done your homework and you ask those questions correctly and you make the right decision, he's going to be tossed. That's the way I would handle that. Okay. If you turn two pages to the top of the page, should say section 1.9, appeals in the nature of certiorari. This is the statute we looked at last time. And appeals, let me just explain for the people who don't recall, appeals in the nature of certiorari. When you start a civil action in court, you file a complaint. Somebody rear-ends me on the highway, I never get satisfaction, I sue him. I do that by filing a complaint. He answers it, and we go forth from there. When you're, so to speak, appealing a quasi-judicial decision, you don't file a complaint. You file a petition for certiorari, which is essentially a petition for asking the court to conduct a judicial review of the record of the proceedings before the quasi-judicial board. You see, a lot of times in Supreme Court citations, certiorari denied. That's where somebody who doesn't have an automatic right of appeal to the Supreme Court petitions the Supreme Court for judicial review and submits a petition for certiorari instead of a complaint. So that's what certiorari means. It's still a civil lawsuit, but it means that the court is going to look at the record below and not entertain any new witnesses or testimony except for what I've highlighted. And this, you'll see, again, see the strikeout? That's what we talked about last time. The court could, under certain circumstances, but was not required to, supplement the record. Again, my example being that letter from the city manager which contained an admission that the code did not regulate short-term rentals theretofore. Here, with the new change, the court shall allow the record to be supplemented if the petition raises any of the following issues. And it goes on to list them. Number one, whether at the bottom, whether a petitioner has or an intervener has standing. Number two, whether there's an impermissible conflict of interest. And let me say another thing about 160D. I think we're all generally familiar with members of a board having a conflict of interest. 160D extends that prohibition to staff as well. So if staff has played a leading role in the presentation of a permit, or staff is responsible for administrative decision making with respect to a development permit, then that staff member has to avoid conflict of interest as well. So that's a significant broadening or extension of that requirement. Getting back to my point, if you turn the page, top of the page, the record shall be supplemented if the decision-making body, if the petition sets forth a claim that the decision-making body made a mistake as set forth in A, B, C below. A being unconstitutional or impermissible limitation of procedural due process, excess of statutory authority, or inconsistent with the procedures outlined by an ordinance. Bottom line is, where the court could, under certain conditions, supplement the record, now the court shall, under those conditions. And regarding the lay opinion of, or the opinion of lay witnesses instead of experts with respect to traffic impact and property values, if you see the highlighted provisions in number 3 and you go down to the highlighted provisions in the middle, and you look at ABC below, here's the bottom line. ABC, A, the use of property in a particular way affects the value. The increase in vehicular traffic poses a danger to public safety, and the catch-all, other expert testimony matters. Those things go back up to the middle of 3, are now legislatively deemed to be conclusively incompetent. Before, you could consider them and give them whatever weight you wanted to give them. This statute says they're incompetent, period. They're meaningless to you. And that's very important, because if you do a lot of quasi-judicials, you will experience representatives of a gated community coming in saying, it's going to destroy my property values. That is meaningless to you unless an appraiser provides that opinion. Or, I don't want that daycare there because it's going to create traffic safety issues. That is meaningless to you unless there's an engineer presenting a traffic impact analysis. Bottom line, you'll hear it. You don't even need to comment. You don't need to tell them it's incompetent. Just realize that when you consider, as you consider your decision, you cannot use that at all, period. Because if you do, and the applicant takes you to court, and he wins, you're going to be paying attorney's fees. So if you turn to the next page, which has no yellow highlights, and then turn to the final page that says section 111, section 1.111, This is the attorney's fees provision that I was telling you about. And the first one, the court shall award reasonable attorney's fees and costs. And a good expert could be $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 worth of cost that will be taxed to you on top of the attorney's fees. If the party who successfully challenged the city's action in any action in which a city is a party, upon a finding by the court that the city took action inconsistent with or in violation of that statute, the court shall award reasonable attorney's fees. I missed the up at the top. Here's the bottom line. You're going to get attorney's fees taxed against the town in any action where the town is a party when the court finds that the city violated a statute or case law setting forth unambiguous limits on its authority. You're going to be taxed attorney's fees if the court finds that the city violated that statute. I don't recall what that statute is right off the top of my head, but it's broad enough to present a risk. And the court, in all other matters, the court may, and that means that's discretionary, may award attorney's fees in all other cases. So the risk of attorney's fees, there never was that risk before. Now it's there in any case, and it's mandatory in 2 instances under conditions that are sufficiently broad enough to allow a half-assed attorney to make the argument, much less a good one.
And this only works, this is only a one-way street.
That's right.
It's only the town, it's not the plaintiff. Right?
Yep.
Yeah, he's free and clear. If he wins, we have to...
And again, this is the developer's bill. So those are your legislative updates. Have fun.
So would the town be better off settling out of court on something like that?
Well, I guess it all depends. Depends on... I would answer that question by saying the town is better served by making sure everything you do is right.
So it sounds like
I agree with that one.
But if you're in court, you just have to analyze it, consider your risk. Mediation is a useful process that is mandatory in all civil actions, but there have been, I've encountered issues whether it is mandatory in matters of judicial review. But sure, the trouble in mediation, here's the rule. Mediation is a refereed settlement conference that's where the mediator seeks to achieve a mutually acceptable compromise agreement. Here's the maxim for a mediation. For a good mediation, no one is happy. Mm-hmm. The person that got the money got less than they thought they wanted. The person that paid the money felt they shouldn't have paid it at all.
That's exactly right.
But I'll tell you, that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. I also used to do a lot of personal injury law, and I always went up against one of the best guys in town, and he always had a maxim which time and experience has shown me to be very true, even in all areas of the law. Don't put principle in front of principle. If you got an effective deal on the table, take it. And don't stand on your soapbox because you'll get burned 99 times out of 100. Those cases were usually, you know, if they were offered 50% of the market value of their personal injury claims and they said, hell no, that's not enough, and what that person did was wrong and I want their license taken. If that person didn't take that, even though it was less, it hurt to take less, it was a profoundly much more intelligent decision to take that instead of having a jury trial, losing, paying the expert witness fees, yada, yada, yada.
Emotional impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you get an acceptable, you know, it's just business. Don't even give it another thought. Take the money and run.
It's just business.
It's all that but nobody sees it as business.
Sometimes it doesn't matter whether you're right or wrong.
Well, that's true too.
So it sounds like to me that what got passed here was an easy way to get around this room right now.
Sure. I mean, it's the developer's bill.
So what I'm getting at does this bill effectively make us obsolete?
No, you still have responsibility for...
Because of some of these things he said.
You are the place that somebody has to go if they get a notice of violation that they disagree, that they want to appeal. This is still the place to go if you get an interpretation from John that you disagree with. This is still the place to go if you make a request to John to establish that you got vested rights and John says no.
Okay.
This is still the place to go if you want a variance.
Okay.
It's just that you need to be on your P's and Q's and not make any mistakes, because the person that doesn't like your decision can go to court, and if he wins, he gets attorney's fees. And in some cases, even though those four things remain your prerogative, if they can make the argument that they meet the condition that allows them to bypass you, that's where they'll go.
Okay.
So your extensive annual workload may actually be reduced. That's a joke. Because you don't have much of an annual workload.
So, well, I don't know if people now, contractors, now find out that, hey, I can take this court.
My home bill money.
And if I win, even my attorney fees are paid, they may decide to challenge more often.
Oh, sure. I think that's what this is all about.
Is this passed by home builders? I mean, were they the main lobbying?
Yeah.
I'm sure they were.
Yeah.
I read about this already a little bit.
Yeah, that's what, remember I told you that the major recodification, Chapter 160D, was passed the General Assembly without any controversy because the home builders said, if you give us this, we'll be quiet about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it got through.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Hey, man, I just pay my dues every year. That's all. I have no idea all the other stuff.
I saw you sitting over there doing your numbers.
No. I'm straight custom, man.
My budget just went up for the year.
I did actually make some notes to talk to my team about, but not, they had nothing to do with this. You just made me think of something that we've... This, what you were talking about, made me think about something totally unrelated. Just goes to show.
I saw your notes. Talk to my attorney about whether we can make that decision unconstitutional. I saw that. If so, go directly to court. Do not pass go. Do not go directly to court. Pass BOA.
I actually realized that the town and a township, not this one, did something to me that they weren't allowed to do by your discussion.
Well, don't forget, these new things that we're talking about only became effective in July.
Well, no, you were given a definition, and I realized that something had happened somewhere that potentially could have been irregular.
Oh, interesting.
You're not going to tell us?
Not while we're having a meeting, but afterwards I'll tell you all about it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's smart.
Well, basically what you're saying is we just need to dot all our I's and cross all our T's during our hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been taken to court, I think, a couple of times in the past, if I remember correctly, and we've prevailed on every one of them so far. So.
It's just that court is always unpredictable.
Okay.
Always.
Absolutely.
You never know. Even with a good judge, you just never know. Much less a jury. I mean, growing up, I used to value the American system and the jury system, but I've seen juries get it wrong so many times, I would almost opt for a bench trial every time. Unless I had certain things going for me.
Can you ask for a bench trial versus a...
If the other party agrees. If somebody makes a demand for a jury, you got a jury trial. But I can tell you horror. I can sit here the rest of the night and tell you horror stories.
Well, you and me both. Yeah, I've had cases I presented that I could have sworn they were slam dunks, and the jury just, everybody went, oh my God.
Well, I sat in on one. I was number two, so I watched number one unfold. Good-looking young lady suffered a permanent injury to her thoracic spine in the middle, ruptured disc or something, and they couldn't, it was permanent because they couldn't get to it because of anatomy. And she had a jury of her peers, mostly women, and she had significant bills, and she had a significant permanent partial disability. She had good lawyers, and good lawyers on the other side had a good judge. I think she had $30,000 in medicals, and I was sitting next to this defense attorney that I was telling you about, and the jury went out, and he said, $60,000-$70,000, that's what she'll get. Well, the jury came in and gave her $10,000.
Ten.
And you can't talk to a jury until it's all over. And when we were all so dumbfounded that I ended up in the elevator going down with some of the jury members, and I just said, I didn't preface it. So she didn't know where I was coming from. I said, how in the world did you only give her 10? And she looked at me straight in the face, and she said, well, she was injured, and she had medical bills. So she just missed the boat completely.
Totally.
Totally. But she felt they had done the right thing. Felt they had done justice.
Oh. Now, if she had spilled hot coffee on her at McDonald's, she'd have gotten $500,000.
Yeah. And that kind of stuff isn't appealed.
That's the scary part. That's of a jury by your peers.
Yeah. Well, working in the industry that I work in, I understand some people are not.
Oh, yeah.
detail-oriented enough?
I mean, people have built multi-million houses for asking me some of the dumbest questions, and I'm like, but people just don't pay attention. Mm-hmm. That's 90% of the they don't pay attention.
Well, that's being gracious. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are just damn ignorant.
Well, I wasn't going to say that.
I don't agree with that necessarily.
Oh, I do.
I think they're just overwhelmed. I think from a vacation rental point of view, people are just overwhelmed. They ask me the same questions.
I think, even though
it's written and highlighted and...
One of the most clever things that I've seen following business is companies like Johnson & Johnson, Microsoft, and there's a whole list of them. They have a corporate rule saying, you tell the other person what you want as if they are a five-year-old. And it's not an insult to their intelligence, it's to be sure that you got your message across.
General discussion.
We really pushed that.
All right, gang. We're recording, so we either terminate this discussion.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Do you have any other questions relating to the training? Okay, good.
Okay.
Well, can I entertain have someone make a motion to adjourn the meeting?
I think Connie should.
I'll make a motion to adjourn.
All right.
Your first motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Our meeting is adjourned at 7:30.